It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Last week, we talked about beginner's mind, Roshi's actual words. In the beginner's mind, we have many possibilities, but in the expert mind, there is not much possibilities. His actual words really bring home the closed nature of the expert mind and the open, fresh nature of a beginner's mind. That said, I don't think it needs to be like every single expert's mind is closed, but he's really thinking of Zen practitioner experts, so to speak, which there really shouldn't be such a thing. That's more of where he's coming from. But Roshi says that our ability to keep this fresh, open, don't know mind is the secret of Zen. And today, continuing from there, but from a different point of view, I'd like to discuss Zen's so-called difficulty. What is this difficulty? Roshi says, people say that practicing Zen is difficult, but there's a misunderstanding as to why. It is not difficult because it is hard to sit in the cross-legged position or to attain enlightenment. It is difficult because it is hard to keep our mind pure and our practice pure in its fundamental sense. I, Suzuki Roshi, am interested in helping you keep your practice from becoming impure. It is the secret of Zen practice. So what is the secret of Zen practice? To always be a beginner. And Roshi says to be very, very careful about this point. When Roshi lived in Japan, before he came to America, he had no disciples. When he sent some of his American students to study in Japan, of course, they wanted to meet Roshi's Japanese students, but there weren't any. In Japan, Suzuki Roshi was seen merely as a temple priest. So when Tatsugami Roshi, who is a big shot kind of Roshi in Japan, when he was invited to lead a practice period at Tassajara, in his mind, Suzuki Roshi really wasn't qualified to be the teacher. After Tatsugami led a number of practice periods at Tassajara, he was actually planning to retire at Tassajara and taking over, more or less, taking Tassajara over, since Suzuki Roshi clearly wasn't qualified. So every trip to the States, he would bring a few more of his possessions. But many of the students at Tassajara didn't like him. They didn't appreciate his rigid style. And in the end, Suzuki Roshi gave the job to Katagiri Roshi. At the time, Katagiri wasn't a Roshi, Katagiri Sensei, and Tatsugami went home. Still, I'm not sure that Suzuki Roshi fully realized how he was seen by Tatsugami and the other Eheiji monks, because there was a real split. Suzuki Roshi left Japan because he saw that Zen was dead. But Eheiji monks, the ones in particular that Suzuki Roshi saw as dead, saw him as unqualified and themselves as the kind of pinnacle of Zen practice. So when Roshi says that keeping one's beginner's mind is the secret of Zen practice, if you said that to an Aheiji monk, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. They certainly wouldn't and didn't realize that Suzuki Roshi had a complete approach to teaching Zen in America that went way beyond what they were doing at Aheiji. So both sides had their blindnesses. The Zen establishment in Japan was blind to its loss of freshness, and Suzuki Roshi seemed blind to the way he was looked upon by his peers. Even his American students were surprised that they were his first students. The Zen establishment didn't realize that there was anything else about Zen to teach outside of what they taught. But as it turns out, there was a whole world. And now, thanks to Roshi, we here in America are the gatekeepers of that world. May we always keep it sparkling. Before he came to America, Suzuki Roshi spent a lot of time learning English because he knew that if he had a group of students who knew nothing about Zen, he'd be able to teach them real Zen. He saw at Aheiji that everyone knew how to do everything and they knew that they knew how to do everything, and that it was all perfect, and that's all. In many temples in Japan at that time, and maybe even now, they didn't practice Zazen at all. In fact, some temples didn't even have a Zendo. So it was hard to find a place where Zen was practiced with Dogen's heart. And this is really what was behind Suzuki Roshi's passion to come here. And so when he starts talking about beginner's mind, he's really passionate. And that's his point. That's, in a nutshell, that's his point. But we need to know what beginner's mind is, and we need to know how hard it is to preserve. It's very hard. It's especially hard to keep our practices fresh. So the situation in Japan was deeply painful for Roshi, and he also felt helpless. When the opportunity to come to America came, he just grabbed it. But it's important to remember what he came for. And it's all in the first paragraph of the prologue of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He came to help new Zen students keep their practice pure. Pure means alive and fresh, not knowing anything but what's right in front of you right now. On the subject of pain, that Roshi was holding from his life in Japan before he came here, I feel called to tell you a story about Roshi's first wife, Chi. It's spelled C-H-I-E. So I'm just going to say Chi. I'm not really sure how it's pronounced. Actually, he had a wife before her, but the marriage was annulled because she had tuberculosis and it was too difficult to run a temple with someone who was so contagious. I think this is what happened. Anyway, he married Chi, the daughter of a priest, and she was a very good wife. And he had four children, two boys and two girls. One day, his beloved Dogen teacher, Kishizawa asked him if he could house a man in his temple who was a difficult person. So just to give you a picture, Suzuki Roshi is married to Ji. He's having children. He's head of his own temple that he inherited from his father. He never wanted to be a temple priest, and he's not loving this job, but so be it. What's on his plate, really. And then he has his main teacher, but he started studying with this other teacher, Kishizawa, who was one of the three or four main Dogen scholars in Japan at the time. I was shocked to learn that there were hardly any Dogen scholars then. And Kishizawa was one of them, and Roshi was studying with him. And so when Kishizawa asked Roshi if he could house this person who was difficult, the difficulty was he couldn't be trained to practice, but he had no place to go. And so Roshi took him in because his own teacher, Kishizawa, asked him to, but everyone in his family felt really uncomfortable with this person, especially his wife, felt very uncomfortable with this man around. And once, actually, Suzuki Roshi went to Kishizawa and said, this wasn't working out, and could Kishizawa find another place for him? But Kishizawa told Roshi to keep him, so he did, despite the fact that his wife and children were saying they didn't feel safe with him. So that's the background of what happened. And what happened was one day, everyone was away, and the man had an axe, and he murdered Chi, hitting her in the face with the axe 5 times. And then Roshi blamed himself for not listening to her and started to pay a little more attention to his children. You know, ultimately, that's his big failing. He was not a good husband or father. What can we say? He was a great teacher for us. But so he started to pay a little more attention to his children at that point. In Japan, he had 2 kindergartens and a few monks that he guided. And what he wanted passionately was what he got in America with us, a group of beginners who knew nothing about Zen. If he could work with a group of people who had no preconceptions, he felt he could teach them the real thing. And I think he listened to us so closely because he had a dramatic lesson in listening. You know, he didn't listen to his wife or children who said they didn't feel safe with this man. So, but what he listened for with us was not our feelings so much as ourselves. He knew that Zazen would strengthen us exactly where we needed it. So he didn't ever get sidetracked. If we had a question, he always answered it from a place of pure practice. He never required himself to, quote, make sense in our terms. He only needed to make sense in Zen terms. Zen has a different kind of sense, as you know, and it's a pure sense. It's a sense of our true nature, a sense of who we actually are. So the first paragraph in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind shows how Suzuki Roshi listened. He knew by osmosis precisely what people thought and heard. Precisely what people thought was hard about Zen which was attaining enlightenment and sitting cross-legged for hours. So in his second sentence, he names these two things, saying, that's not why Zen is hard. He picked up everything, even though he didn't speak English that well. So he heard things, and then he started knowing us, and he definitely got our attention when he said just the opposite of what he heard in our gossip and complaints. So, you know, he picked up what we're complaining about, you know, Zen is so hard, and it's hard to sit so long and so forth. And so he says, that's not why Zen's so hard. Here's why Zen is so hard. It's hard to keep the practice pure with our fresh and alive mind. But I invite you to think really deeply about this story of his wife, Chi. And what would you have done? Kishizawa was one of the leading Dogen scholars in Japan that had only 3 or 4 Dogen scholars at that time. Roshi continued to study with him even after he came to America. In fact, Roshi considers Kishizawa his real teacher, from whom he got his real understanding. But he didn't stand up to him. He didn't say, we can't have him. My family doesn't feel safe. I rarely hear this story mentioned, and I've never heard what Kishizawa thought, or if he ever made an apology even. That's why I tell you and ask you to think deeply. It must be a key event in Roshi's life, but it's hushed up, and I'm unhushing it for whatever reason. I guess because we can't have hushed up things if we're talking about purity. So what are some of the mistakes we make in practice? Roshi says, it is when your practice is rather greedy that you become discouraged with it. So you should be grateful that you have a sign or warning to show you the weak point in your practice. So this means that greed, you want to get something from your practice. So even if it's just an idea that your practice is good, there's a sense of, you know, I'm going to all this trouble to sit every day. What am I getting from it? And if I'm not getting anything, is it worth it? This kind of thinking. Roshi is calling greedy thinking. And when we catch ourselves doing it, we can take that as a red flag that we have a weak point in our practice. You know, our practice is not so good. As soon as we see a greedy sign, that's a signal that, you know, uh-oh, we're losing our beginner's mind. We're losing our freshness and our purity. Usually when we practice Zazen, we become very idealistic and set up an ideal or goal that we strive to attain. But when you have some gaining idea within yourself, by the time you attain your idea, your gaining idea will create another idea, because our attainment is always ahead. We'll always be sacrificing ourselves now for some ideal in the future. And so we end up with nothing. And this is absurd. Even worse, Roshi does not like this. Even worse is to practice Zazen competitively with someone else. Roshi says this is a pure, shabby kind of practice. And I think he saw that I know for sure in the beginning days, when I was at Tassajara, there was so much competition of just, you know, it was almost like sitting Zazen was a competitive sport. Just, you know, how late could you stay in the Zendo after the evening Zazen was over? And you're just going to show how sincere you are and stay later, or be sure to come early to Zazen periods, or show no sign of weariness. It's all these things. And Roshi did not approve of that. And it was very prevalent. Our Soto way puts emphasis on Shikantaza, which is just sitting. Actually, we don't have a name for our practice. When we practice, we just practice. And whether or not we find joy in it, we just do it. Whether we're sleepy, whether we're tired of practicing Zazen, whether we feel we're repeating the same thing day after day, we still continue our practice. We just do it. That we just do it, that's the essence of it. We just do it. So I know a lot of you feel, what am I doing? I'm just full of all my thoughts. This is nothing. I can only stand it for 10 minutes or whatever, all these things. And Roshi says, just do it. Use that as a sign that your practice is greedy. That is, you have some idea of how it should be. And when it's not that, you get so discouraged, you don't even want to do it at all. And it's a signal of a bad attitude, really. And this goes for practicing alone as well as in a group. There'll always be a way to tell whether our practice is adequate or not. And becoming tired of practice or disgusted is a warning sign. It signals a gaining idea that we think we know what our practice should be, and it isn't that. So, which means our practice isn't pure enough. That's what it actually means, that our practice isn't pure enough. And at that time, forgetting all about mistakes and renewing our way, we can resume our original practice. And Roshi says, this is a very, very important point. He emphasizes, as long as we continue our practice, we're quite safe. Since it's hard to encourage ourselves to continue alone, especially without becoming involved in some poor kind of practice, we have a teacher. And with our teacher, we'll correct our practice. We may have a hard time with him or her, but at least we'll be safe from wrong practice. Roshi says, whether or not you have difficulties with your practice, so long as you continue your practice, you will have pure practice in its true sense. Even when you are not aware of it, you have it. So Dogen Zenji said, do not think you will necessarily be aware of your own enlightenment. Whether or not you are aware of it, you have your own true enlightenment within your practice. Dogen said that. Another mistake is to practice for the sake of joy. Roshi says that actually, when our practice is involved in a feeling of joy, it is not in very good shape either. It's not poor practice, but it's not true practice either. And he tells us that in Hinayana Buddhism, or Theravada Buddhism, practice is classified in four ways. First, the best way is to just do it without having any joy in it, not even spiritual joy. This way, you just do it forgetting your physical and mental feeling, forgetting all about yourself in your practice. And this is called the fourth stage or the highest stage. The next highest stage is to have just physical joy in your practice. Here you find some pleasure in practice and will practice because of the pleasure. And next you have both mental and physical joy or a good feeling. And these two middle stages are stages in which you practice Zazen because you feel good in your practice. And the last stage, the fourth stage, is when you have no thinking and no curiosity at all in your practice. And these four stages also apply to our Mahayana practice. And the highest one is to just practice, to just do it. That's all, just do it. If you find some difficulty in your practice, that is a warning that you have some wrong idea. So you have to be careful. Just continue knowing your weakness. Here, there's no gaining idea and no idea of attainment. You do not say, this is enlightenment or this is not right practice. Even in wrong practice, when you realize it and continue, there's right practice. Our practice cannot be perfect, but without being discouraged by this, we should continue it. This is the secret of practice. So this idea of keeping on, keeping on, keeping on, that's the secret of practice. Just keep on keeping on. Roshi says there is no particular way in true practice. You should find your own way, and you should know what kind of practice you have right now. Knowing both the advantages and disadvantages of some special practice, you can practice that special way without danger. So we need to know what we're doing. You know, my practice is this, and you should know what's good about it and what maybe isn't so good about it. And if you do that, you're out and continue to do that, you're safe. You have a pure enough practice. But if you have a one-sided attitude, you will ignore the disadvantage of the practice, emphasizing only its good part. Eventually, you'll discover the worst side of the practice and become discouraged when it's too late. This is silly. We should be grateful that the ancient teachers point out this mistake. In other words, we should see both sides of our practice, what's good about it and what isn't so good about it. You know, I sit every day, but I only sit for 10 minutes. Well, it's right now, it's the best I can do, but I'm really faithful about doing it. I sit every single day, and I know it's only 10 minutes, but so be it for now. Maybe soon I'll be able to sit for 15 minutes. I'm just saying how you can be thinking. And Roshi takes this one step further. He says, when we rely on one-sided understanding, we lose the purpose of our study. So to study Buddhism means not only Buddhist teachings, but everything. To study everything is to study ourselves. And to study ourselves is to forget ourselves. And to forget ourselves is to be enlightened by all beings. When what we study will teach us something which is real and true. Dogen said, to study ourselves is to be enlightened by all beings. And this enlightenment goes on forever. So what I like about today's talk is it's short and sweet. It's like it makes one main point that's so important, but it's not that hard to grasp. But here are some of the mistakes that Roshi points out that we can make in our practice. So these are what I'm thinking of are the most important things said today. First of all, Roshi's opening statement, people say that practicing Zen is difficult, but there is some misunderstanding as to why. It is not difficult because it is hard to sit in the cross-legged position or to attain enlightenment. It is difficult because it is hard to keep our mind pure and our practice pure in its fundamental sense. I, Suzuki Roshi, am interested in helping you keep your practice from becoming impure. Secondly, actually, when our practice is involved in a feeling of joy, it is not in very good shape. It is not pure. It is not poor practice, but it's not true practice either. So we're not looking for like, oh, I love my practice, you know, and I'm so happy with my practice. We're not looking for that. We're just looking for day after day. Thirdly, when we're sleepy or tired of practicing Zazen, or tired of repeating the same thing day after day, even so, we continue to practice. We just do it. So that we just do it. You can say that to yourself when you're, you know, reluctant to spend the next whatever time sitting Zazen. You can just say, well, never mind, I'm just going to do it. And fourthly, Roshi says, so long as we continue our practice, we are quite safe. So another mistake is to not continue your practice. Fifth, it is when your practice is rather greedy, and greedy means greedy for something perfect, that you become discouraged with it. So you should be grateful that you have a sign or a warning signal to show you the weak point in your practice. Sixth, usually when we practice, we become very idealistic and set up an ideal or goal which we strive to attain. But when you have some gaining idea within yourself, by the time you attain your ideal, your gaining ideal will create another ideal. Because our attainment is always ahead, your gaining ideal will always be sacrificing ourselves for some ideal in the future. We end up with nothing, and this is absurd. But even worse is to practice Zazen in competition with someone else. Roshi says, this is a poor, shabby kind of practice. So thinking about, well, that person sits, you know, till midnight, then I'm going to sit till me. Roshi does not encourage any kind of thinking like that. So what those six points that I just read to you, I'm thinking of them as common mistakes. So the idea for your reflection this week is to pick out two of these six common mistakes that Zen students tend to make. And pick out two that you see yourself tending to make, and make a plan to correct yourself. and then monitor yourself as you practice the correction to see what for you are your obstacles and find ways to address those. So on this sheet of the idea for your reflection this week, I'm going to list all six of those general, you know, the most common mistakes that we make, and ask you to pick out two of them that you find yourself making, or maybe that you make the most often, or maybe that you find the hardest to correct. And then really try to correct them, find some way to correct them. And then notice what your obstacles, why am I having such a hard time? I'm trying to sit in the morning, and in the morning is my busiest time with my children. And so it's almost impossible, and I just don't even get 5 minutes. So then, the obstacle are my children or the time that I've picked out. So maybe I should see if there's another time. That's what I mean by identifying your obstacle to these problems that you're running up against for your sitting practice. Well, the talk was short today, and I want to invite questions. And I particularly want to invite you to ask questions about your home personal practice, or your personal practice, if you have one that's not at home, because this will be my last chance to help you with that. And that's the most important thing, is how you're doing day to day with your Zazen practice. And not only your Zazen practice, but your focused mind on whatever's right in front of you right now. So please, in these next couple of weeks that we have left, please ask me whatever obstacles you have to having the kind of practice that you want. I'm really wanting to help you as much as possible. So thank you. Please ask anything you want right now.
So Gil, we have a question. We have a few questions, but the first one is that I heard that someone asked Roshi, you've talked about words without sound. May we hear without ears? Do you know what Roshi answered?
Mm-hmm. He wants us to hear without ears. And why? Because he wants us not to stick to his words, that we should accept them with our whole body and with our whole practice. So Roshi says, you should hear what I say as if it were a bird, as if you were hearing a bird singing during Zazen. You're the boss. Nothing happens without you. And even though you hear something, this is part of your practice. Nothing happens outside of your practice. So this is how you hear my talk without ears. You hear me speak with your whole body. With your whole body. I remember when I left Zen Center, I felt it's my body that really understands everything that just happened. My mind is kind of blank. And I had that realization, but I didn't know at that time that was actually correct. That's how I should feel. So it's a great answer that yes, listen with your body instead of with your ears so that you don't stick to words. And words lead to quibbling, and Zen isn't a quibbling thing. Zen is so basic. It's just utterly our own nature. It's our original nature. Zen is the rock bottom original nature. So nothing to make complicated. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So there is another question which had come last week towards the end. So I'll just ask you that one as well. So someone had asked, when one says that when the mind is satisfied, we keep our precepts. At this point in our practice, what are those precepts?
The precepts, there are a trillion precepts, depending on who you are. And if you're a monk, there's, I don't remember how many, 250 or something. And if you're a nun, there's more than that. I don't quote me on those numbers, but nuns have way more precepts than monks. And lay people mainly have, I guess 10. And even before that, some people have only 5. And the 5 are, you all know them, do not kill, steal, lie, commit, have sexual impropriety, and misuse drugs. Those are the big 5. When our practice is pure, those things don't exist. There is no such thing as killing. And when our practice is pure, there's no killing. It's not thou shalt not kill, it's just killing isn't. So Roshi is making a direct connection between pure practice and keeping the precepts. And it's almost like he's saying they're the same thing. So you almost don't even need to worry about the precepts. You can just worry about what he's calling pure practice, which is to stay very present with this moment right now, and then this moment right now, and then this moment right now with a don't know mind. That's Zen practice. So it's very uncomplicated. Thank you. I don't know how better to explain it. It's almost like the more words, the further from what he's trying to say gets. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another one that we got in our chat. So somebody asked, why is this your last series?
It's because while I was on retreat, I made a decision to return to writing as my main practice, as opposed to I was playing music. I was playing the banjo, most of you know that, for 6 years. And I'm going to take up writing narrative fiction, which is different from poetry. So it's a whole new endeavor. And it's rather complicated, actually. It's there's a lot of things involved in it. And so I don't think it'll be possible for me to continue to write Dharma talks as well as that. And so because there's not enough time to do both, I'm going to do this other practice, which is something that I wanted to do even before I became a poet. So it's an old longing, and I'm really very happy to have this be something that I focus on in the last years of my life. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one we have is, if I practice for 20 minutes and am satisfied with that, do I keep practicing longer until I'm not satisfied? Will the length be based on physical limitations?
In terms of daily practice, it's said that the most important thing is the daily part. So the thing to be sure not to change is that you do it every day. The fact that you practice 20 minutes, I think it's perfectly fine. And if you practice 20 minutes every day and feel satisfied, that's even more fine. I don't think you need to make any kind of effort to increase that, but you may find that you start wanting to increase that. One day you just have the desire to, like, well, what would happen if I said 30 minutes? And then you try it and you notice a difference in a good way. So then you can either say, well, I think I'll do 25 minutes or whatever. But what I'm saying actually is, what not to sacrifice is the daily part of it. It should still be every day. And I think it's fine to sit for 20 minutes. And you don't need to change that until you just have an inner sense of, I think I want to try to sit for longer. That would be a good reason to experiment with sitting for longer. But there's no need to push yourself. I think that I'm reminded of when I was teaching, like, I think they were kind of 9 to 11 year olds to meditate. And so we sat for 10 minutes in their Sunday school class, which I was teaching. And the instructions given to Sunday school teachers was, this should be made as pleasurable as possible, just as smooth and easy as possible, and no, the idea, what we were teaching was sort of ease. We were teaching a kind of sense of comfort and ease with meditation, and not this like pressure of you should. And I think that still holds. Even if you're not now in Zen, this was in a self-realization fellowship. In Zen practice, as I was saying today, Roshi's not that big on joy, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't feel that we can rest into our practice. There should be a certain sense of connection with what you're doing physically. You don't have to feel like, oh, I love this so much, but there should be a sense of connection and stability and even dignity in what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one that we have is, isn't seeing both sides a kind of seminal Buddhist teaching?
Yes. Roshi goes so far as to say that if we can't see both sides in anything, we're not seeing clearly. So until we can see, I mean, there's so many examples to give that right now. So just think of your favorite issue that's going on in the world right now. Roshi is saying, you should be able to see my side and their side. And until you can see both sides, you aren't seeing clearly. And I think that's a tall order. But Roshi says, until you can see both sides, you aren't seeing reality, because reality always has both sides. So he calls this kind of teaching the double construction, or the double nature of Buddhism. The double nature of Buddhism. And a good example is putting emphasis on the self instead of putting emphasis on selflessness. And really, we need to put emphasis on both self and selflessness. And that's Suzuki Roshi's teaching. So, and all of his teachings are seminal Buddhist teachings. So yes, seeing both sides is a seminal Buddhist teaching. Yes, I think it's really hard. It's really hard for all of us. And especially now when there's so many issues that seem so clear, which side is right. But Roshi says we have to see both sides. Thank you.
So the next one that we have is, I've heard everything you have said today, but can you say anything about my doubt? How do I know whether my Zazen is true Zazen, or my practice is true practice, or my effort is right effort?
Roshi is emphatic on this subject of doubt. He says, don't doubt. Don't doubt your practice. Just do it. So the same thing of just do it. It honestly, if you don't remember anything else from today's talk, remember, just do it. That's because that's the critical piece. He says, that's true practice, is this attitude of just do it. And if you have doubt, he says, you should just get up and join our practice. That's good enough. You don't need to think any more than that. And then your practice will be true practice. If you think too much, you'll lose your true practice. So don't think too much or even try too hard. This is one subject he's super clear on. And he, you know, doubt is anathema to Zen practice. just simply do it. Just do it. Keep on keeping on. Just do it. And you'll be safe and it'll be pure practice, no matter what you think. So long as you're continuing. And if you're continuing on a daily basis, even better, then you're really in good shape. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another one that we have is, what about expectations? Although we know that everything changes, including ourselves, we expect everything not to change. How do we reconcile these contradictory messages?
So that's the double structure of our nature. It goes back to that other question about the seminal teaching of, you know, the double standard of Buddhism, or the double nature of Buddhism. So we know intellectually, we know everything changes. And then in our actual behavior, we act as if we don't want anything to change. And so since we don't want it to change, we kind of go along expecting things not to change, but we know they do change. So there's both of these things going on, and that right there, that we expect something that's contrary to what reality is where our suffering is born. We create our own suffering by expecting something other than reality to be the case. And so we, all of us pretty much make this mistake of, or we kind of trick ourselves into thinking, well, it hasn't changed so far, so maybe it won't change. But it will change. And actually it has changed so far. We change every second. So the point I think that Roshi adds to this is that that is the formula for suffering. That is how suffering is made. Believing in something that's contrary to reality, to how things actually are. And never believe that things actually are anything other than everything changes. So you can catch yourself doing that. Just if you watch, you'll see yourself creating your own suffering in this way all the time. I think we just do it. Well, I see I need to stop. And I want to be sure to thank all of you for coming. I'm so grateful that you attend these talks, and some of you attend, go to the trouble of attending during the week instead. And I want to thank my team, Brendan and Brian and Sahar, for all of the work they do behind the scenes to make these talks possible. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.